Salutations, everyone. This is ACTGS. My name is Roy. I'm an XSO operator for this, the Limewalk Technical Net. Limewalk Technical Net has been going on for 40-plus years, mostly under the care of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent P a few years ago. But in his memory, we continue Technical Net and hopefully spread the knowledge amongst us all. Some have more in certain areas than others, so they share it with us, and we share it with them, and we learn and teach each other, hopefully entertain. So the idea is for this to be an enjoyable experience, and I hope you all come expecting that. Once again, let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, if you would like to contact me via email, either for a mailbag question that you can't answer, ask it during the technical net, or if you would like to suggest a topic for discussion, either one that you are interested in offering up, or to be part of, or to listen to, that's another reason. Also, if you have a puzzle to share, we're always looking for technical puzzles that aren't very easy to answer by Googling. So if you have one of those, please share it with me, and if it works for my purposes, I will share it with the rest of the gang here. Also, if you want me to poke Paul on the shoulder and have to take a look at a NASA space-related story and give his view on it, that's another good reason. So my email address to do that is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2g.com. If you'd like to contact Paul WS2N directly, you can use his email address, which is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a link page full of interesting articles, occasionally YouTube, so they're up 24/7, available at any old time. So if you have nothing better to do and want to read some interesting articles, or at least articles I felt were very interesting as the previous week, type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's very active, sometimes it's very quiet. The way to get to it is to type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. I also offer audio streaming on the internet of the technical net, and I keep it up the rest of the week, so you can listen in to the Glen Oaks repeater if you're not near a radio. You just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that will give you the audio stream. Also want to remind people of Mike KC2NJI. He has a great archive site called amateurradio.tv. It's had over a million visitors, and he has archives of this technical net going as far back as September of 2006. So when you have a chance, take a look. Randomly select one of the archives, and I'm sure you'll learn something new and useful. Let me drop for a second, and I'll be right back. Okay, very good. Hopefully, we'll have some questions tonight, preferably of an amateur radio-related subject matter at the beginning. As time goes on, we'll open things up so that any science, technical, and otherwise the subject will be open for discussion. As I've mentioned many times before, we do not treat nor diagnose over the radio, but we can discuss broad-term concepts in medicine if there's any interest in any of that. So with all that in mind, if anyone has any questions or comments for the technical net tonight, please hit that push the talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
Coming in. 10-2-8-6.
Getting 2-0-G-B, just standing by.
Okay, Rich recognized, although you did cut out rather quickly, but I recognize your voice. And Wesley recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for any questions or comments for tonight?
2-0-G-B, just standing by.
Oh.
Okay, Craig recognized. He's just going to stand by. Craig, if you develop any particular questions, there'll be time for that, I am sure. So let us take the first person on our list tonight, Rich, W2BZ. I hope there was no problem with that kind of quick cutoff at the very beginning. What's your question or comment tonight?
Hello, Roy. Hello, everyone. Excuse me one second. My question deals with DMR and kerchunking. Sometimes, let's say if I'm on 91, talk route 91, I don't hear anything, but then if I kerchunk, then a station pops up. And I'm wondering, every time that you change from talk group to talk group, do you have to hit the push the talk button? Whether you're using a hotspot or going into a repeater. I thought that kerchunking changed its function when everybody started moving to hotspots away from repeaters. So is kerchunking still needed when you're using a hotspot as opposed to a repeater?
It is generally good practice in DMR land as opposed to any other place to kerchunk. Theoretically, if you're going through some place like Brandmeister and you have set Brandmeister for a single static talk group, it should remember that that's the talk group that you're assigned to and should allow you to communicate without kerchunking. But just to be on the safe side, because I have had Brandmeister many times forget the static talk group that it was set to. So it's always good practice to kerchunk to make absolutely sure. Otherwise, whatever network that you're using may not remember which talk group you're interested in. The only way for it to really know is either you kerchunk or that you've entered it into their own website, a non-erasable form, like Brandmeister is supposed to work. But I've, again, had times where I've set a single talk group as a static talk group. Now, there's also a dynamic talk group that, after a certain amount of time, disconnects. So make sure that if you're going to use things like Brandmeister, make sure if you really want to lock in a talk group, make it a static talk group, not a dynamic talk group. But it's always good to kerchunk, because it's one less possible reason for an error where it seems as though the talk group is quiet when there's a lot of activity, but your router device doesn't know that it's supposed to get fed with that talk group.
That's what I thought. Also, moving from talk group to talk group, do you have to disconnect each time you move to another talk group?
Again, it's good practice to do so. I would think under some circumstances, if you fail to do that, you might end up being able to hear multiple talk groups at the same time, which would be kind of confusing. You know, if you don't physically disconnect from a static talk group and you decide to enable a dynamic talk group, there might be some leftover where if there's nothing on your new talk group but there's something on the one that you didn't formally disconnect from, it'll put it through and block the talk group that you're interested in. So, again, matter of good practice. It's always a good practice to disconnect from the previous talk group before you another one.
It's a little bit confusing because let's say I'm on 93. I see four bars as if there's a signal on 93, but there is nobody on 93. And so with that signal I'm looking at, I'm not hearing any audio, but I'm seeing the four bars, like the radio is receiving a signal, just not modulating it. And I'm pretty sure that I see those four bars coming from other talk groups. Would that be the case?
Well, I mean, hopefully you place your DMR in promiscuous mode. If you're going through a hotspot and you're seeing bars, which means that the receiver portion of your radio is receiving a signal, then the radio itself is squelching the digital signal, and usually that's because it's not in promiscuous mode.
Mine's definitely in promiscuous mode. Without a doubt, it's in promiscuous mode. But I think it has something to do with ka-chunking, moving between two talk groups. In other words, if I go to 93 from 91 and I ka-chunk, I don't think I'll see any. I have to test it out, but I don't think I'll see any bars and hear no audio.
Okay, I mean, it would be a good experiment. I mean, the way that I conceive of DMR operating is the only time that you'll get an indication of signal reception without a signal is because at the level of the handy-talkie itself, it's applying some kind of a squelch, which shouldn't be the case if it's truly in promiscuous mode. The whole point is that it no longer checks to see what talk group it's set for in order to drop the swell. So you could try it as an experiment and come back and tell me how it worked out.
But looking at the screen, Roy, I'm not seeing anything come up on 93 when I'm seeing the four bars. So if it was in promiscuous mode, shouldn't it also switch to a screen where you see the guy's call?
Yeah, I would think possibly so, but who knows? It depends upon the firmware of the handy talkie. It might be in the other channel, because your radio is a two-channel radio. So stranger things have happened, but yeah, I would think so, that you would just receive the signal, and it would show up as on the display itself.
So what you're saying is best practice is always ka-chunk and always disconnect, huh?
Yep, my attitude is belt suspenders and what the hell table gun. It takes a fraction of a second more, but it's less likely to cause some kind of complication and problem that'll have you scratching your head.
Yeah, okay. It's two extra steps, but I know that things could get messy without doing both. Sometimes when I hit 4,000, it doesn't come back and say disconnect. What do you think that's about?
Well, it depends. It might just be some kind of strange little blip with the digital signal where it's not acknowledging it. There are some hotspots that have built-in disconnect. When you go to a web-based command interface for things like OpenSpot, I think there are places where you can insert a disconnect signal before you hit the button for the new talk group. I don't know if handy talkies are capable of adding that little feature into it, but I would be surprised if that happens at one point or another. But, you know, it takes a little bit longer, but I don't know how many different times you change talk group. Probably much more than I do.
I just really switch between 93 and 91. Basically, those are the two talk groups. I see very little activity on any other talk group, and a lot of times I see very little activity on 93 and 91. It's not like it used to be for some reason, especially 91. That was, you know, constant, and now you could get 5-10 minutes in between hearing any signal on 91, which is definitely a change from the way it used to be, you know, a year, 2, 3 years ago. Do you notice that at all, Roy?
Well, I mean, I don't think I've been quite listening to 91 and 93 lately. I have some, you know, favorites that I've almost hard-coded my hotspots into listening on. You know, it's like anything. Talk groups are like repeaters and you know, like the regular old HF band. The culture is kind of ebb and flow and change. I am not terribly surprised because when I was listening a great deal to 91, talked about it in the past, there was this familiar story that a lot of guys had where they just came on and were a little bit befuddled by the technology and told the people listening to them that either their son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter had just brought over a hotspot and a handy talkie, and they had been licensed for decades but recently weren't able to maintain a jack, and this was their attempt to regain some of that. Usually doesn't bode a heck of a lot for the future. I would assume since it kept on happening and very few people responded that, yeah, that happened to them a year ago, that it's kind of more of a phase. The people come on, get a new gadget, play with the gadget for a while, and then put the gadget aside. So it doesn't surprise me a great deal. A lot of technologies get an initial boost, and then it kind of settles down. This has not been the case for something like FT8, which is still going very, very strong. You go to the FT8 frequencies, and you're still seeing a lot of people trying to make all kinds of great contacts and earn their wallpaper and such. But, you know, different technologies have different lifespans. So, who knows? Maybe there'll be a new cluster of talk groups that interest people as time goes on. I don't know. I think, unfortunately, digital radio is a great idea, and it's a very useful thing. But, you know, I think a lot of people check it out, not that excited, and they move on to something else.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
You guys know a lot about the DMR radios. I'm wondering, if I had two HTs that worked on DMR, could these two talk to each other, you know? You know, you're going camping or something, you have one person with one with the other. I know a lot of people use DMRs, and family radio service or the general mobile radio service, DMRS, but they're all FM. Are there any HDs that could actually talk to each other without going through the repeaters, without going through the hotspots, without going through the internet? You know, just, you know, where two radios can communicate with one another. I wonder if they have that.
I believe it's possible, I think, and this is all very theoretical because, surprisingly, I don't think I can remember anyone actually operating DMR Simplex and telling me about it. But there are two tiers in DMR protocol. There's Tier 1 and Tier 2. Tier 1, I think, was the original design more for person-to-person contact. And it was only later that it was upgraded to Tier 2 that allowed a repeater to be involved in the experience and expand upon the capability. And one of the things that really upset a lot of people was Baofeng presented a DMR radio, and they didn't tell people that it was a Tier 1-based DMR radio, so they decided to buy one and to contact their hotspot or their repeater, and they couldn't because it was Tier 1. So, in theory, I think they are capable of point-to-point contact, although I haven't read anything about doing that. It doesn't seem to be a subject of discussion any place that I've read.
Tell me if there's any expert some information.
Certainly, Jerry.
Okay, I don't have them offhand, but there were four DMR simplex channels, at least on the DMR Mark network, and the talk group is 99, so there are four simplex channels, 446, I think, 050 or 075, there's a 433 something or other. Just look up DMR simplex, and I know in DMR Mark it's talk group 99, and it's basically simplex, just like 14652. Back to net.
Okay, my only problem is that that would be network linked. So if you were in the mountains and you talked to another guy at the other side of the mountain, how would the network pick up that signal unless there was a repeater nearby, which is not the frequency that you're using for the simplex operation?
No, it's just straight simplex. It's talk group 99 just goes through. It's like it's a PO. Like if you have two simplex radios and you have the same PO, you can talk to each other. So with talk group 99, you can talk to each other. Same idea.
Okay, I'm just kind of losing the idea of how it's being networked, because you would need something with an internet access to do the networking, right?
No, there's no network involved. You're just talking on the same channel. You're transmitting and receiving on the same channel, and 99 is like similar to a PL. So it's like 4ZPL. You're going from one radio to the other radio. As long as your talk groups match, you actually can make up any number you want, but basically the standard simplex is talk group 99. You can talk to each other with two radios.
Okay, but you know, as you mentioned, since you're not being networked to anything, as long as both people agree upon a talk group configuration, you can operate point to point. Again, surprisingly, never really read much on the subject. It doesn't seem to elicit anyone's comments one way or the other. But, you know, it's possible in sort of the same way that other digital modes are possible to be point to point. D-Star brought out the ability to star on the HF band as a point to point communication digital mode that I'm sure almost no one ever tried. So, you know, all these things are theoretically capable of point to point communication. It's just apparently hasn't taken too many people's great interest to document it too much.
Boy, if, you know, to do a private call with DMR, you just put in the other person's DMR ID number, and you call them, and then nobody else can hear the conversation. It's just, you know, between you and the other station. But that's different than putting in a talk group number, because I agree with you, DMR takes place over the internet. So if you remove the internet from it, it almost seems like, you know, simplex UHF or VHF rather than DMR.
Well, my understanding of how these things work is that basically a talk group is a ID number. So you know, the ID, you have a particular ID number that's a private number. I have an ID number. Everyone who operates DMR gets their own private ID number. But as far as, I guess, the software is involved, you can either direct your call to a public ID number, which is what the talk group really is, or a private ID number. Now, I wonder about promiscuous mode, if there is a way that promiscuous mode might get around that security aspect of sending a signal to the other guy, directly to the other guy's private ID group, ID number as a talk group.
WB2QGZ.
SPGZ.
Hey, good evening. Yep, yeah, if you're in promiscuous mode or any one of the monitor modes, you'll hear all the traffic on the channel. Without, you know, you'll just see everything going by. when you want to get two DLM portables or mobiles to talk to each other, and I do this all the time, you just have to make sure the settings line up, right? So you can look at color code like it's a PL. That's one of the settings. The time slot, you want the time slot to match, you want the color code to match, you want the talk group to match. It doesn't matter what the radio's ID is. It doesn't even need to have an ID, really. But as long as your color code talk group and the color code time slot and talk group match, and you put the radios on a simplex channel, they'll talk to each other without a problem. Back to net.
Okay, that's good. That's sort of how I thought it worked, and that's really what part of Tier 1 capability is, right?
Well, my understanding is that the Tier 1 had an issue with time slots in sync. So if you tried to use a Tier 1 radio on a repeater, you would you'd be lighting up both time slots, I think. So obviously Tier 2 is, I wouldn't say retroactively compatible, but it works the same way. It's just you have to pick a time slot. So you could pick time slot, any time slot you wanted, one or two. You could pick any color code you wanted. You could make up a talk group of one or six digits, as long as your radios match.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. Again, I'm kind of surprised in retrospect that there's very little written or kind of said generally about it. I guess the people who know just know and do it and don't really discuss it with too many people. But thank you for that, and makes complete sense to me personally. You don't really have to bother with any Grandmeister servers or any network servers. It's a direct, one-to-one type of communication.
Roy, let me see if I have it. If you're both on Talk Group 91 with the tier matching and the color code matching, you can't take over 91 with your simplex communications. It would have to be like the other guy was saying, I guess, on 99, that I'm going to Google Talk Group 99 on Grandmeister and see what comes up.
Okay, but you know, I think we're talking apples and oranges. In the case that Paul was mentioning, basically you have a DMR radio out in the sticks where there's no repeaters anywhere around, and your friend has another DMR handy talkie, and instead of switching the frequencies and the color code and the time slot to a local repeater and using the repeater, you're just agreeing to use the same frequency, color code, and slot for the two handy talkies, and then an agreed upon ID for as a talk group or whatever you want to consider it, and then you just transmit, and because you're on the frequency and you have the proper talk group set for both handy talkies, you directly talk point to point. It's no longer, you're taking these networks out of the equation, because the networks are bound to DMR via repeaters. Not individual users don't have, unless you have a hotspot, there's no way to really connect to any of those backbones. So you're going from point to point. You could use a talk group of 99. You could use a talk group of 1,001. As long as both of you are using the same talk group, color code, time slot, frequency, should work.
I guess. Interesting. I've never come across Talk Group 99 and Simplex UHF 99. It says here Talk Group ID 99 UHF Simplex channels. Interesting. I'll have to look that up myself. Back to you, Roy. Thanks.
Okay. Yes. Look it up and read up on it. You want to come back and tell us about it. I don't know what exactly the benefit of a network-based simplex, I guess, for people who want to kind of do point-to-point and don't want to share their communications with other people, perhaps. I don't know. Something I have to take a look at as well.
that's what a private call is. If you gave me your DMR ID number and I put it in and called you as a private call, then we'd be talking to each other without anybody else listening, you know, creating our, like my DMR ID would be a talk group and your DMR ID would be a talk group and we'd be talking to each other like that. That's what a private call is.
Yeah, but as I was talking to Bill, WB2QGZ, you know, that was pretty much the idea before promiscuous mode became a thing. If you have your handy talkie set to promiscuous mode, it's no longer a squelching, non-configured talk group. So my guess would be that it wouldn't be terribly private under those circumstances. Could be wrong, but that's the way it kind of sounds to me once you add promiscuous mode to the equation.
They have, I'm looking under DMR simplex frequencies. They have frequencies of 441.0, 446.5, 446.075, and then 433.45, then 145.79, and 145.50. So there are four UHF simplex frequencies on Talk Group 99 that Talk Group 99 can use, and two VHF. Well, how do you like that?
Okay, I assume it's vaguely similar to the standard simplex frequencies on the UHF and VHF FM analog. That everyone knows that theoretically, if you want to have a simplex conversation on VHF, you go to 146.520 and you call out. And theoretically, if you make a contact, you then move over to one of the secondary public simplex frequencies so you don't clog up the calling frequency. So I guess they set up something like that and connected it to repeaters and nodes and such. I would be curious if anyone really does that. You know, I guess theoretically, if you're in a urban environment where there's a lot of frequencies in use, you would prefer a standard set of set aside frequencies to do your simplex operation. Theoretically, as I would assume, you don't necessarily have to use the Talk Group 99 configuration. They're doing it as a commonality so that if you would like to use simplex, you can turn to that frequency, turn to that talk group. A stranger can look at the same table, turn to the frequency, set the time slot, set the color code, and set the talk group. And so you have a published standard where you don't have to make a prearranged agreement. If your friend and you are going to the mountains, the two of you could come up with almost any acceptable legal configuration, and as long as they're identical, you would have a great point-to-point simplex method.
This is really something. I'll just read simplex frequencies and usage. Occasionally, you want to use your radio without having to use a repeater. We have that covered. You can program your radio with the following information and use your radio in simplex mode, no problem. And then it lists the six frequencies. It says, please do not use the 2-meter 146.520 or 440.446.0 analog channels for digital simplex as they are not narrowband digital use. So there you go. Learn something new every day on the TechNet, every week, every Sunday on the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
APCGS, as do I, Rich. Yeah, so it's just a mutually agreed upon arbitrary collection of frequencies, color codes, time slots, and designated IDs so that people can read it off of a list, set it into their handy talkies, and see if they can find some other guy who read the same article and operate point to point instead of going through a repeater. So Again, it's an interesting idea. I'm not quite sure if I ever, well, I know I never tried it, so I don't have the faintest idea what kind of simplex activity is going on those designated simplex channels. I mean, if you ever get around to testing them out, feel free to tell me how active they are. My guesstimate would be not terribly active, but, you know, who knows?
Let me see if I have it. I do. Okay. Very good. Thanks, fellas. Another thought crossed my mind. Let's say you have two radios, and you think one isn't working right. Is this thing getting out? You know, I'm not getting into the soft group or whatever. Set it up with another radio just to see if it's working. So, you know, just something simple like that. It would be good to do. So it's good to know that you have those capabilities. As you can tell, I don't have DMR. I got the GMRS and all that, but I don't have that. Back to you.
Yeah, unfortunately, companies decided to make their own particular version not play well with others. So, you know, I think there would be more people personally if there was one voice digital mode. But instead, we have D-Star, we have Fusion, and we have DMR for amateur radio operators, and in some cases P25. And there's a long list of commercial digital voice modes out there. They're all sort of proprietary. They don't interoperate well. And you have to either choose your digital mode wisely or acquire at least three different radios to handle most of the most active of amateur radio versions of it. But yeah, you could do something like that to test your handy talkie. There are also echo servers where you can log into, if you have a proper connection, and you can log into a talk group that will simply echo your transmission back to you. So that's another way of testing digital mode radio communication.
Okay, good stuff. It sounds like back to you, Roy.
Okey-doke. So, Rich, has your question hopefully been pretty much answered? Any other questions or any more, anything else on this particular subject?
Unfortunately, there are not a lot of DMR hams that will use it because they go where the action is. But if two of you agree that that's what you want to do, it can be done, and they say DMR simplex is noise-free, so it's a big change from analog simplex, and makes digital simplex much more enjoyable, as this article said. Anyway, thanks, Roy. Learn something new.
Okay, very good, Rich. Yeah, that's a perpetual conversation. Is analog better than digital? Is digital better than analog? There are some people who prefer the digital synthesis of one version more than others. You know, sometimes a particular digital mode annoys their ears. They just hit the artifacts involved. Also, it depends on your distance from each other. Digital signals do degrade over long distances. You know, if you have a relatively short distance, there's very little noise. But if you're relatively short distance from your other guy with an FM radio, a lot of times you're full quieting and you have a pretty good sound quality. So, six to one, half a dozen of the other. I have listened repeatedly on 520 for FM simplex. It's intermittent. It's active, but not, you know, not all the time. But there are little flurries of communication. I would be deeply curious to know what kinds of activity exists on the simplex DMR frequencies. I would probably bet not terribly active, but yes, I don't know. clear with any other questions related to this particular subject? If so, hit that push to talk button. Okay, then I guess we're going to move on to Wesley and to SJS. What's your question or your topic for tonight, Wesley?
Okay. Electric bees or electromagnetic bees? Swarm experiment via VLF and electric field, also bees. And visualizing DMT using your phone and in near field. Okay. I'm going to start with something that may be interesting to ham radio operators. There is a video that I have sent to Dr. Roy. I'm not sure if he had the time to do them. Okay. The video that shows the demo of a handheld near field scanner that allows visualization of electromagnetic field in three-dimensional or in 3D in real time using augmented reality. So actually what it does is it's a small C-shaped device. On the top of the C you put your phone with the app loaded into it. And it becomes a 3D scanner of electromagnetic field. The interesting thing is that you have something in that C which would be near field, which would be your antenna, or that could be if you have a vertical antenna, horizontal antenna, or if you have another cone or anything that makes electromagnetic waves. Then this device on the screen of your phone creates a three-dimensional cloud. It's like a cloud with very fine boundaries, and it's three-dimensional, and it has a color. So the most of the intensity that you have into it is in the red color, and then it changes to yellow and to green, and green is like the less saturation of EMI. We want to use it for EMI. Let me just. So, if you have a shield box for some electronics that you have, and you want to adapt it to your antenna, you can also see if there is any leakage. So, rapid EMT, EMI, troubleshooting, visualization of emission from the circuit board if you want, producing 3D graphics of EMI, and checking RF leakage from joint ports and gaskets, verifying shielding effectiveness of enclosures, and evaluate and compare emissions performance of components. Now, the good thing is that this app works from 50 Hz to 7 GHz. So, 50 Hz, we're talking about a very low electromagnetic wave, if there are electromagnetic wave or any kind of EMI. And 7 GHz, we're talking about, 5G, 4G, 2.4 gigahertz telephones, and all of the gadgets in between, including radios. So, scan phone allows for the connection of the low-cost spectrum analyzer, if you want to connect to it, of course. So it's not only the phone, to extend the functionality. With that spectrum analyzer connected to and set to zero span mode, it is possible to set the bandwidth of measurement. This allows for the rapid troubleshooting or specific narrow band emissions measurement or spotting in the system where there are multiple emissions taking place. So So this is really good. What I was thinking is, how do you call it that nano? It's like a small spectrum analyzer, nano. Oh no, that's the DNA. Do they have also like an expensive spectrum analyzer, Dr. Roy?
AC2GS. Yes, they do. I own one of those as well. They're very nice. Again, very small. Not terribly well protected. If you drop it too many times, you're probably going to have a broken one. But yeah, there is also a similar spectrum analyzer type of device. That's kind of the spectrum analyzer version. But the nano VNA is VNA.
Yeah, so without spectrum analyzer, external spectrum analyzer, just on the phone, you can have a measurement BW set by probe response, so bandwidth, right? Measurement of bandwidth set by analyzer RBW, which is with or without external analyzer, and then general field visualization that would be interesting to ham radio operators who wants to look at their, let's say 70 centimeter antenna that is standing in front of them near field, and see that absolutely amazing picture. It's tri-dimensional. It's like wrapping around that antenna, wrapping about it, and you see the extension of it. Let me jump. Okay. And EMI troubleshooting, if you have EMI, but that can be done only with external analyzers. So there are certain things that you could do just with your phone and the app, and certain things that you can't. So it's really, really amazing. There is another quote. I'm going to read it. Rapid EMI troubleshooting visualization of emission for circuit board, team management information and communication, find RF leakage from joint gasket EM and RF educational tool and antennas analysis. Okay, so that would be about that. Again, I don't know if you, Dr. Roy, saw that video when it shows that you can actually, with your app, you can stop the cursor and make the data collection so the cloud becomes more visible. And then you see something that is like a tri-dimensional object, which is actually the pattern, the cloud pattern with very fine edges on it.
Yes, Wesley, I saw the video. By the way, for people listening, the inexpensive spectrum analyzer is called Tiny SA, Sierra Alpha, Tiny SA. It goes for about $85 on Amazon and such. So if you're interested in playing with toys and $85 isn't a big ticket for you, take a look at it on Amazon. But getting back, Wesley, I saw it. It has a couple of gotchas. The way you describe it, it sounds like it would be nice if it worked this way, where you just kind of put it in the area and it does a three-dimensional scan. So you have to apply your own expertise to generate that three-dimensional collection of data. You have to move the probe in all three dimensions in a standard sort of way, and the probe is capable of detecting your movement, so it knows where the detector is in relation to space. So you have to go across the plane, then you have to go to the next level up if you want really 3D as opposed to 2D. So it's an interesting concept, in somewhat the same way that people are using thermal images on test equipment to see if components are overheating or aren't heating at all, to get an idea of what might be causing problems.
Thanks for it. The name of that device is ScanPhone, one word, ScanPhone 3D EMI scanner, augmented reality. Did I properly pronounce the word augmented?
Yes, you're exactly right. There are two types of imaging technology around. there's virtual reality and augmented reality. Virtual reality kind of wipes your background completely and redraws your visual surroundings from nothing. Augmented reality augments what's really there by projecting images of electronically synthesized images on usually a set of modified glasses, but you know they can reflect it directly into your eyeball if so inclined. So augmented reality is something they've been working on a lot in the lab. It hasn't really come out as much as virtual reality, you know, because now you have to have real things play well with synthetic images and such. But you pronounced it fine.
Yep. One more thing. The device is actually the C-shaped piece of metal. Has nothing on it. And at the bottom of that C-shape, you actually put your probe, which is connected. Oh, it comes with the probe. It comes with the probe at the bottom of it. So the distance, so the C-shape is to keep the distance even when you're moving your C-shape device with the phone on the top of the C. You always have the same distance, and that's how you can have more or less even pattern of the cloud.
Wesley, you still have to have some kind of gyro, accelerometer, and other such, because you have to be able to estimate where in space your C-shaped device is, even though the distances in the C-shape don't change. The distance from the C-shaped device to the board that the probe is probing changes as you move the probe to and fro. So it may use the cell phone's accelerometer and compass and other such things for a good idea of its location in 3D space, or it might have some similar circuits built into it. I don't know.
I'm going to expand the discussion a little bit more. There is a two other types of 3D scanners using laser. There is a handy scan 3D. You don't have to memorize it. It's metrology grade 3D scanner. You just take any object, let's say a wheel of your vehicle or your vehicle by itself, and you can scan it. And you can have a copy of that scan in 3D version on your software in your computer. Some of them are unfortunately very expensive. There is the old and the wireless one, which is called All Driven 3D Scanner, which is 26,700 euro. And this one has a screen on it. So while you're scanning, you actually see how the scan builds up on the screen of the device that you're keeping holding in your hand. And the next generation of the scanners that have nothing to do with electromagnetic fields, but at least you could take it as something that is good to know. Mr. Roy.
Yeah, they certainly do exist. People certainly use them. You can see people using them. There's loads of them uploaded. One of the problems, as you mentioned, is that the really good ones tend to be really expensive, because the really good ones are kind of designed for industrial use. So they use latest, greatest technology, high-quality parts, and very durable design. Usually, these things tend to need to be repeatedly calibrated to do the best job. The problem with a lot of these things is that they depend upon the objects that are scanned to have a uniform reflection. If you have an object in real life, you'll notice that it's usually more than one color. This drives a lot of these pieces of equipment slightly crazy. And so it has to be smart enough to adjust for different surface reflections in order to generate a good 3D image. But if you're willing to spend a lot of money, there's stuff that does amazing, incredible stuff for really next to no money. There are cute little software algorithms that you can take multiple photographs of an image at different perspectives, feed them all together, and they'll put together something that is close to what you're trying to get at. So there's a lot of different options available in price ranges for 3D scanning. Of course, once you 3D scan, a lot of times what people do it for is so that they can put it in a 3D printer and generate a copy. You know, if you have a broken knob and you need a replacement knob, that's a great reason to have a 3D printer. For a couple of years, I went to the Limark get-togethers and demonstrated the results of 3D printing. And, you know, with a 3D scanner and a 3D printer, you can do kind of incredible things.
Okay, any question about the subject?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. The next subject is B. I'm going to go to B. First, correct me if I pronounce properly the word swarm. S-W-A-R-M. Swarm?
Well, it depends upon your region. In Brooklyn, I call it swarm. But, you know, there are variations, unfortunately.
Okay. So a swarm experiment, VLF, very low frequency and electric field with bees. And then we have a bees and electricity, bees and electromagnetic waves, and bees and sound. And I was trying to employ to explain the phenomena, point source. The main difference of electrostatic electromagnetic force and a characteristic of electromagnetic waves. So it looks like a mix of everything. Let me jump. Okay, I assume Dr. Roy had a chance, although it was late that I sent the video, that the bees were producing electromagnetic waves. Of course, Dr. Roy might say that there were electrostatic charges, but first let me ask, did you see the video?
AC2GF, yes, I saw all the videos, Wesley, and I usually, I'll repeat myself, I have this line that I keep on using. Charges that are not moving produce an static electric charge. Charges that move at a uniform rate produce magnetic fields. Charged particles that move at a changing rate, an acceleration, produce electromagnetic waves. So it's possible for static charges in motion to produce electromagnetic waves.
Because you only use much better, could you explain to the audience what was that video about?
Okay. The guy who I think was heavy into bees got himself a signal meter and detected that a swarm of bees sitting in an area beating their wings furiously were generating electromagnetic emission, which makes sense. They have these thin little wings. They probably build up electrostatic potentials with the air, and they move them back and forth at a rapid rate, accelerating the charge, the static static charges producing electromagnetic waves. So he picked up that a swarm was producing a measurable amount of electromagnetic waves. When he isolated only about five or six bees doing it, the signal strength dropped below his equipment's means to measure it, And so his explanation is that bees give off low-level electromagnetic waves, which makes perfect sense to me.